And welcome to By the Book. This is the Nachum Segal Network. My name is Nachum Segal. Welcome to another fresh edition brought to you by Koren Publishers. Go to korenpub.com, korenpub.com, for a look at some of the most amazing titles out there as we get an opportunity each and every week to check out what's happening in the world of great Jewish publications. In this case, Koren and their Magid label or Magid imprint has provided for us Rabbi Levi Cooper. Rabbi Levi Cooper is author of a brand new book entitled Relics for the Present, Contemporary Reflections on the Talmud. Rabbi Levi Cooper, originally from Australia, teaches at the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem and serves as the rabbi of the Hatzor congregation in Tzur Hadassah. His PhD, awarded by Bar-Ilan University's Faculty of Law, explored the interaction between Hasidism and Jewish law. Rabbi Cooper is a member of the Israel Bar Association and the Tzohar Rabbis Organization and serves as a historian with Heritage Seminars. He publishes The Tish, a column on Hasidism in the Jerusalem Post, and is a contributing editor for Jewish Educational Leadership, the Lookstein Center for Jewish Education Journal. Rabbi Levi Cooper, welcome to the Nachum Segal Network.
Hello.
Usually, Rabbi Cooper, I start with why'd you write the book. I am going to save that question for a follow-up to this question. What would you say is the definition of a relic?
Oh, that's a good question. For me, a relic is something very precious that's from the past, something that we cherish, and something that perhaps at first blush one might think it really just belongs in the past and doesn't have relevance for today.
Not to minimize the contribution of the great Talmudists and your analysis of their work, but aren't most things relics? Can't we learn something or appreciate a lesson from almost anything from a different era?
Well, I would certainly hope so. I think that that's exactly my contention in the book, that we can look at the Talmud, and even though it's a relic and some people might look at it and say, this isn't really relevant to my life, these relics are for the present. They have timeless messages and relevance for our day and age as well.
Okay, now the question of all questions, as they say in my business, why'd you write the book?
Well, I had a great opportunity after teaching Talmud at Pardes to begin writing a column for the Jerusalem Post. And it was really something extraordinary because there was a student at Pardes, and she finished her time at Pardes, Amanda Borschel, and she went to be the editor of the magazine of the Jerusalem Post. And she came to the magazine, and at the time there were two Parashat HaShavua columns. And she said, well, look, that's great, but why don't we also have something on Talmud? Mm. And she turned to me and said, "Would you're my Talmud teacher, would you be willing to write the column?" And I hadn't written regularly before that, and I had a lot of, I wasn't sure whether to take this on, because to write a weekly column was a big undertaking. And in the end, I said, well, you know what, I'll give it a burl, give it a shot, why not? And since then, it flowed, it was, and it turned into, from there, I began writing on Brachot at the beginning of the Daf Yomi cycle. And 7 years later, I put out this first volume of Relics for the Present.
The one of the unsung heroes, I would bet, in this project, in addition to the editor whom you just mentioned, would be deadlines. When you have a deadline of meeting it once a week and trying your best to not break the deadline, so to speak, it does help get the written word down. Am I correct?
That's so true. And even though being a teacher and a community rabbi, there are deadlines, nevertheless, writing something and having to come up with something new every week for the newspaper really pushed me, but I think it pushed me in a good way, and it forced me to be thinking creatively and to set aside weekly time to write those articles. And it was a very positive experience for me.
Oh, I can only imagine. Like I say, the deadlines only produce something positive. I think someone once said the worst part of releasing a book is the writing process. The best part is once the writing is complete.
I don't think for me that was the worst part, because it got my creative juices going. Mm. And in a way that they hadn't had to produce in the past. So I saw a side of myself that I hadn't really seen previously. So it wasn't the worst part. I think it was much harder for me coming up with the title than coming up with something that was, on one hand, innovative, but wasn't just a kitschy title, something that might catch a person's eye. I think that was probably one of the hardest parts of the project.
Understood. Rabbi Levi Cooper is with us via telephone. The book is entitled Relics for the Present, Contemporary Reflections on the Talmud, a Magid Books, Koren Publications release, with an imprint by Pardes, the Institute of Jewish Studies. Rabbi Cooper, it is amazing when you go through this book, when one goes through this, when you consider the incredible vast a number of topics that are covered in Masechet Brachot, and I would guess that this is basically the tip of the iceberg. Would you agree? Could you give us an overview from your perspective of this unique volume of Talmud?
Well, I think you're very right in what you're saying, Nachum. Brachot is an exciting tractate because, on one hand, it's got a lot of things that are relevant to daily Jewish life. But as with the Talmud in any place, it goes off on tangents and which can reach places that you wouldn't have expected to get to when you're sitting down to study that Masechet. And if you add to that the array of commentators, each one of the commentators taking it in a different direction, so that's fertile ground for anyone who wants to study and try and find meaning in the text.
Do you continue, by the way, your weekly presentations in the Jerusalem Post beyond Maseches Brachot?
Well, I went to, when I finished Brachot, so the editor at the time felt that it was time for a change, and we bounced around a few ideas, and in the end we decided that I would write on Hasidut and try and offer stories, history, ideas, and so that's what I'm working on at the moment, and the past couple of years that's been the focus of my column in the Jerusalem Post.
And that is what is called the Tish, the column on Hasidism in the Jerusalem Post, and I'm sure I'll ask about that a little later on in this hour. The Brachos, as we know, a lot of people are familiar somewhat with Brachos, even those who may not spend their days completely enveloped with the work of the Talmud, still most likely at some point in their Jewish educational career came across the Mishnah or the Talmud of Brachos, and therefore you get an opportunity really through this Masechta to talk about some of the things that many of us are familiar with. You start with Shema. I notice that your second chapter deals with day and night. And what I'd like to get a clear picture of is what does it mean, contemporary reflections on the Talmud? And in this case, the word contemporary. For instance, when you write about day and night and this amazing tradition of ours that is so different from the rest of the world, that Jewish days do begin during the night, again, a big discussion in Maseches Brachos. What is the contemporary lesson or the contemporary halachic a conclusion that we are supposed to take with us today from that discussion of centuries ago?
Well, first I would just respond by saying not that we're supposed to take with us, because I'm not suggesting that what I'm writing is what we're supposed to. I'm just trying to show a possible avenue for how to read the Gemara. And in that particular passage, I'm suggesting that the family life and coming home is the way a Jew starts his or her day, rather than leaving the home in the morning. And that can indicate to us the importance of the Jewish home.
Very good. That our timeliness is, we have to focus on coming back to the home as opposed to starting the day with leaving the home. So are there, I understand that there's a lesson in there, but that lesson can, in theory, can go through the generations. In other words, not a lesson that necessarily is in today's modern era. It's yet another generation like others that can appreciate something like that.
Definitely with that one, it does apply to other generations. I think the Jewish home and the Jewish family has been a value for our people. It's not a new idea. But I think that what I've tried to do is to find something that would have meaning for our generation, not necessarily to the exclusion of other generations. I'm just looking for something that a person like myself, like my peers, my students, we would read this passage and say, well, this has something in it for me in my time as well.
Right. So is there a little bit of, I don't know, I don't want to say Hasidism, although we did bring it up earlier, or a little bit of Musser Hasidism, a little bit more of an approach like that to this work?
Well, I don't think Musser is what I would describe it as. That's not my background. My background's more in the Hasidic world, and that's certainly my leanings. So if you notice, I do quote a lot of Hasidic commentators, Hasidic masters, and very often I will recount their readings of the text. Yeah, definitely there's Hasidus in the readings, but I don't think it's solely a Hasidic reading of the text.
Understood. Rabbi Levi Cooper is with us via telephone. The book is Relics for the Present, Contemporary Reflections on the Talmud. One of the conversations that we've been having a lot here through actually more than one program, it's really been bridging the gap between different types of shows that we present here, is a conversation about leadership, leadership and failings in leadership and who ends up being leaders specifically among the Jewish people as opposed to others who you'd think might have a better capability of filling a leadership role, but they may have been lacking something or they may have been too good for the job, so to speak. One of the things that you write about, admitting that we don't know. And admitting that we don't know is something that I think is a trait that real leaders would take on. Real leaders would go ahead and admit, whether it's a leader of a family, a group, a school, a classroom, or, of course, you know, all the way up to the Jewish people, so to speak. And there are people who are not capable of going ahead and doing so. What do we learn? What in Maseches Brachos brought up this topic of admitting something we don't know, or admitting that we don't know?
You know, it's tempting for me to answer that question by saying, I don't know.
You might. I had a feeling you might say that.
You set me up for it. But I think that you highlighted leadership, and that is one of the themes that goes through my book because it's a topic that is on my mind as well. What makes a good leader, and how can a person who's striving to be a leader, how should such a person act? At Pardes, we have a lot of students who go on to leadership positions in America. And so this is a topic that that is constantly on my mind and looking at Masechet Brachot, trying to find some inspirations for those leadership questions. You highlighted the one about the passage where I speak about a leader saying, I don't know.
Right.
I think that for me, the key passage in Relics for the Present is there's a chapter entitled Preservation and Innovation.
Right.
And in that chapter, I talk about the tension between leadership trying to preserve the tradition and leadership trying to innovate, forge new paths. And that, for me, is emblematic of the leadership challenge. How do we balance between those two values?
Do you then conclude that there was that there were people among Jewish leadership that were much better than others, or a type of personality that would fit better as a leader than others?
Well, I don't think I really try not judging to avoid judging leaders. I'm more talking about paradigms of types of leadership. But the Gemara does lend itself in that the passage that talks about when Rabban Gamliel was deposed from leadership and talks about his leadership style as being somewhat authoritarian. And I suggest that Rabban Gamliel, though, was representing the need to preserve the tradition, as right. opposed to Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, who is representing the desire to innovate, to come up with new ideas, to be inclusive, to be welcoming. And the Gemara there at the end of the passage talks about a power sharing agreement between the two sages. So without going beyond little Levi Cooper judging Rabban Gamliel and Rabban Elazar ben Azariah, I look at these paradigms and suggest, look, we have leaders who preserve, we have leaders who innovate, and there needs to be a bit of a balance between the two so that we continue the tradition, but we also don't freeze and become fossils of Jewish tradition.
Now may I enter a controversial aspect of this topic then? And especially if you're constantly writing on Hasidus, and it may not be the fault of the leaders, it may be the fault of the Hamon Am in this case that I'm about to outline, but we do see very often that constituents of leaders and constituents of Hasidus Rabbanim or Beim in particular often don't accept the fact that they're lacking anything, and certainly would never accept the fact that they don't know something. Is that in fact a problem with today? Because one of the things that I think is unfortunate in our community, in our global community as a Jewish community today, is that we believe, many of us, that our Torah leadership is infallible.
Well, I certainly am not pushing a view that sees any human as infallible. I think that we're humans, we have challenges, and we falter. And even though we falter, we try to get up again and do better. I think it's a shame when a person abdicates responsibility for thinking for themselves and forging their own path. I don't think that means that a person can't seek counsel, can't seek advice from people who are more adept, whether it's knowledgeable or spiritually adept. I think that that's, there's a certain humility to going to people who know more than you. But to abdicate total responsibility for decision-making, that's certainly not the line that I'm suggesting in Relics for the Present.
Right, I understand that. I'm sure you're not suggesting it. I just think that it's one of the problems we face, is that often we cannot accept when a leader or a Rebbe will say, I don't know. And I think that that may be a problem with the Hamon Am in general, not just... not blaming the leader themselves for it.
Yeah, I think we face a lot of challenges as individuals. It's never easy for a person to say, I don't know. I don't think, even though I've dealt with it in the book, that doesn't mean that I'm walking around saying, I don't know the whole time. We don't like to admit our own lackings. So I'm not sure whether I would see that as a specifically Hasidic a problem of the Hasidic community. I think that that's our modern sensibilities. We like to have a front of being very confident and of knowing things, and so we're hesitant to say this is beyond me. I think that's a challenge that many of us face.
Very good. And as you indicate, it looks like it's been a challenge for many, many generations. Rabbi Levi Cooper is with us, originally from Australia, teaches at the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem, serves as a rabbi of Atzor V'Hatzohar congregation in Tzur Hadassah, Israel. He is a member of the Israel Bar Association and the Tzohar Rabbis Organization. He publishes the Tish, a column you'll find on Hasidism in the Jerusalem Post each week. Rabbi Levi Cooper is author of the brand new book, Relics for the Present, Contemporary Reflections in the Talmud. It's a Magid Books release, and that, of course, means that it's under the umbrella of our wonderful friends from Koren Publishers, korenpub.com, korenpub, korenpub.com. My name is Nachum Siegel as we explore this work on By the Book. So you ask a question in Relics for the Present, does God keep mitzvot? Why would we think he does?
That's not my question. That's the title because that's what the Gemara says. The Gemara describes God in some way, whatever that means, keeping mitzvot, God wearing tefillin and doing other things that that we're instructed to do. It's a very strange image, and perhaps one that would be easier for me just to ignore. But on the other hand, looking at that image and thinking about what does it mean that God's doing the mitzvot? I think that suggests a paradigm of trying to imitate God, trying to follow the mitzvot that we do, trying to follow in God's footsteps. I don't think that God really physically has tefillin. I think that's the case there in the Gemara, even though the Gemara goes as far as to discuss what's actually written in the tefillin of God. And the Gemara there says, well, in our tefillin, we declare the unity of God. So in God's tefillin, God declares the unity of the Jewish people.
Right.
So that's a lovely idea. I don't think that God actually has black boxes that are being put on every day.
That he has to check every few years. You wouldn't think that's the case.
Yeah.
And is it important for us symbolically that we relate to a God that would quote-unquote perform mitzvot, or maybe put it a different way, that mitzvot are important to him? Kaviyachol, is that an important image for us going forward and in our own observance?
I don't think it's an important image. It's a possible image. It's one image that exists, that exists in the tradition. And for some people, that's an image that they'll connect to. For other people, that's an image that will be anathema and they won't want to have anything to do with it. You know, I'll share with you, when I started writing, one of the first couple of weeks, I got a phone call from a prominent author, and she said to me, I like what you're writing in the Jerusalem Post, but why didn't you skip a certain passage in the Gemara, passage that describes the death penalty? Mm. Why didn't you skip that? Why are you sharing this with all your readers? I said to her, it's not me. It's the Gemara. So she said, yeah, but you could pick and choose. Now, I felt that if I want to be honest in presenting the Gemara, then the challenge of reading even difficult passages should be tackled. So not everything in the book is necessarily it's not a book of, I suggest that this is the way to relate to God, or this is the way to perpetuate Jewish tradition. I'm reading the Gemara and trying to say, well, what could I draw from this passage that might have relevance for us?
Understood. By the way, what is the Talmud's discussion there about the death penalty?
The Talmud talks about for people who transgress certain rabbinic enactments, they are liable for the death penalty. So it's not a passage that's really suggesting that we start executing people who don't keep rabbinic commandments.
Right.
And I suggested there that it's trying to show how serious we view rabbinic legislation.
One of the things I love about the book is that you outline in many, many cases, in more than one chapter, the difficulties with what our tradition tells us. In other words, I'm looking, for instance, at page 80 on the subject of plundering Egypt. And many of us have always had difficulties with the command to go and quote unquote borrow from Egypt once the Exodus was announced and carried out. Correct? That was the directive from God. Correct?
Right.
And you outlined that. You pointed out and discussed many, many different points of view. But you don't hesitate to bring forth what people's initial reaction might be to this directive.
Yes. And I think that particular particular chapter that you're talking about was one of the more difficult ones for me to write, because it is such a difficult problem. Why are we commanded before leaving Egypt to plunder Egypt? Why should we do that? Why do we need to do that? And as you said, I've tried to collect as many commentators, both on the Gemara and biblical commentators, who have grappled with that very issue and suggesting their answers. I think for me, in that particular case, as I write there, just the fact that they're grappling gives me inspiration. It shows me that they're also uncomfortable with this part of our tradition. And it teaches me a bit of humility that maybe I don't have all the answers, and I'm allowed to grapple with parts of our tradition that don't sit well with me.
And anybody who would like to explore all those different opinions, they can then, I guess, feel best with the opinion that sits best with them, right? Essentially.
Right. Or or choose, as I did in that particular case, not to be comfortable at the end of the day with any of them.
Right.
I present them, and just by all means, if a person connects to one of them, I always note in brackets where I got the explanation from, so that a person who would like to explore it further could go to the source material. But and if they connect to one of them, that's great. And if they don't, that's also fine. In that particular case, that's my conclusion. I'm just I'm fascinated that everybody's grappling with it. Not sure that any of the answers really let me sleep comfortably at night.
Right. I mean, Rabbi Cooper, I think what you're saying is so vital, only because often at any age, whether it be young kids all the way up to Talmudical Academy ages, I think we are encouraged to be satisfied at the end with something. We're encouraged, oh, it's a Talmudic passage. It has to make sense, or there has to be a way to reconcile, you know, X, Y, or Z that may not seem, you know, to be sitting well with us. I think your approach may be a healthier one than the approach that often we're told.
Well, I think it also perhaps reflects reality. We're not always happy with the outcome of things that happen in our lives, with projects that we undertake, with things that happen. That's part of our lives. And looking at the texts and seeing part of our tradition as another part of our life that we grapple with, that we try to fit into our lives, and occasionally it doesn't fit in. And that's the reality. So I think it is healthier, as you said, but I also think it reflects reality in a more accurate way.
I didn't know Talmudists were allowed to be as level-headed as you are.
I don't know. You'd have to ask a Talmudist whether they'd agree that I'm a Talmudist.
Understood. Rabbi Levi Cooper is with us. We're exploring Relics for the Present, Contemporary Reflections on the Talmud, his brand new book. What is the Book of Remedies?
The Book of Remedies. Look, the Book of Remedies is a text that that we don't have, but that the Gemara talks about. And, you know, we don't really know the details of what was in that book of Remedies. This was another case where I felt, look, it's in the Gemara. I can't skip it.
Right.
I have to relate to it. But it's not something that necessarily is part of our everyday lives.
And it came from what era?
Oh, you've caught me on that one.
Because
I don't know. I don't know that the answer to that question.
Because I mean, and the reason it's in your book is obviously there's a reference to it in Maseches Brachos.
Right.
And the question, and are any of the details from the Book of Remedies in Maseches Brachos? Any of the past?
Not as far as I remember.
All right, so it's just a reference to it as a general concept.
Yeah.
And in general, when we look at the Talmud, and I'm no expert, quite obviously, but when we look at the Talmud, there are, in general, I don't know, medical advice, medicinal suggestions, writings about things done to help people in difficult medical situations that we likely would not do today. Does the Talmud end up being, and Maseches Brachos in particular, a source for things medicinal, for things that when it comes to health?
Well, look, there are cases in Brachos. There's cases all over the Talmud of medicinal advice. And I know that there are some people who like to read those passages as proper medical advice. But already Maimonides, the Rambam, looked at that Talmudic advice and said, well, I think I'm, as a physician, I think I can offer different advice, different holistic medicine. So I wouldn't suggest reading the Talmudic medical advice if a person's got an ailment. I think it's probably better to go to a qualified doctor.
Understood. Rabbi Levi Cooper is with us. You have at the very end of your first chapter of Brachos, you have something called What's in a Name. And this is a topic that has always fascinated me. Very, very often. I think more often than not, but, you know, who knows? You know, it's, I guess we'd have to take a statistical study. But so often we meet people whose names really allude to a significant part of their personality and really allude to something that, or refer to something that is, of dominance, either in their personality or just in their behavior in general. What can you tell us about, Kishmo Kein Hu, about names reflecting what people are all about?
Well, I think that the particular chapter you're referring to in Relics was inspired by a trend that I've seen amongst my peers. I think that that many people, you know, in days gone by, people used to give their children names, often named after someone from a previous generation.
Right.
Nowadays, it seems that people give their kids philosophies rather than just a name. And they give their children names that has so much meaning or so much hope for their children's future. And in fact, that is an accurate reflection of many biblical names, that the names have particular significance. And in that chapter, I was connecting to that trend. As far as Kishmo Kein Hu, as you suggested, I think that a name is an opportunity. A person can connect to a name, but it shouldn't be seen as something limiting. When I was a young boy growing up in Australia, so my name's Levi Yitzchok,
right.
And I have a very clear memory of going to shul, holding my father's hand, and an old woman seeing me walk down the street, and she called out, Reb Levi Yitzchok mi Melbourne, and as if to say, I was the Reb Levi Yitzchok of Berdichev, but from Melbourne. And from that time onwards, I thought that I was a Gilgul, a transmigration of Reb Levi Yitzchok of Berdichev's soul.
Now, that's a good thing that you thought that, or a bad thing that you thought that?
Well, for me, I think it was a good thing. I think it had a positive effect on my life. I think that Reb Levi Yitzchok of Berdichev is a beloved Hasidic master and a person who cared about other people. And I think that thinking as a young kid, and there are some things you really never grow out of, thinking you're continuing Reb Levi Yitzchok of Berdichev is something that's a challenge, that challenges you, in my case, challenged me to be a better person, to be a kinder person, to judge people positively as much as possible.
Right. I mean, I no question about it, but I think in many ways it sometimes can be overwhelming for a child, and it can be overwhelming for somebody in their teens when they think about what their name is and what it means. I mean, we're conducting this conversation. You're in the state of Israel. I'm on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. We're in an area where, you know, if you explore well enough, you're going to find children with names of very prominent Torah giants from previous generations right now in this neighborhood. I think in a way it might put some undue pressure on some of them.
That's possible, but I would suggest that there the issue is not the name, but it's how we educate our children and how we try and present to them that the name is an opportunity, but they're their own person. How do you balance between saying to a child, on one hand, you've got this name, you have a legacy that you could fulfill. On the other hand, you're your own person. And that's an educational challenge that parents, educators that we face, I don't think we should blame the names for that.
Understood. Like I said, you're level-headed, and it certainly sounds that way. Here we are at the Nachum Segal Network, by the book, brought to you by our friends at Koren Publishers. I want to ask you a couple of things in reference to some of the efforts you're involved with outside of the world of publishing. Then I'm going to come back. There are a couple of more topics I'd love to explore with you in regard to the book Relics for the Present. First, about Sohar, could you explain to our audience what type of organization Sohar is, what they are trying to accomplish?
Okay, sure. I'm happy to explain it. I should say as a caveat, I'm not a spokesperson for Sohar.
Right.
I'm a volunteer in Sohar. And Sohar is an organization here in Israel of young rabbis who would like to make the various life cycle events, in particular weddings, more accessible, more user-friendly to the general population, while remaining within the dictates of halacha. So Tzohar rabbis typically found at weddings, officiating at a wedding of perhaps a couple that might have chosen not to get married at a Jewish wedding, and because they've had the opportunity to go to weddings, it's a great opportunity to bridge the gap between different communities here in Israel. Unfortunately, one of the great challenges we face here is the separation of communities, and Tzahar is doing a little bit to bring the non-religious community to Jewish tradition and to see some of the beauty of a Jewish wedding.
It's a real big picture approach. I mean, you're talking about weddings in particular and life cycle events, and we know how important, well, you know, the regulations are and what needs to be followed, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a much bigger picture to it. As you just said, we're trying to incorporate and encourage as many people as possible to stay involved with Jewish tradition, correct?
That's right. That's right. And here the challenge is different to at least what I'm familiar with in Australia, because here a person just living here in Israel is likely to be involved in some way in Jewish tradition. The national holidays are the festivals. So it's very easy to be part of Jewish tradition, but when it comes to the stage of a wedding, so a couple gets to make a choice, and they can say, well, do I want to be married according to Jewish tradition, or would I prefer to get married in Cyprus? So Tzahar is offering, within the chief rabbinate, is offering an avenue that a person can say, yes, I'd like to get married, but I'd also like the ceremony to be a little bit more open, a little bit more the style that I would like it to be. So Tzahar rabbis will always sit with the couple before the wedding, go through the exact stages of the wedding, explain what every stage is about. And sometimes you get a request that a couple says, look, I'm really not comfortable with that particular element. And then the rabbi needs to be knowledgeable enough to say, well, that element we can't skip that element, otherwise it won't be a Jewish wedding.
Right.
And then there are other cases where the rabbi can say, well, actually, that element is a rather late custom, and if you're not comfortable with it, then we don't need to have that as part of the ceremony. And that I've found that makes the entire wedding to be the Jewish wedding to be a very positive experience.
Mm. And also, as one of the things you touched on earlier, in terms of Hasidism, so you've explored the interaction between Hasidism and Jewish law. Now, frankly, there are some people who would look at that topic as a general topic with some skepticism, and please understand this. I'm not suggesting, God forbid, that members of Hasidic sects automatically are casual when it comes to Jewish law. But there are certain things, it seems, especially when it comes to the time that is, and we're talking about Maseches Brachos, the time that is designated for Tfilot. Doesn't it seem that the Hasidic community seem to take more liberties when it comes to those rules than other communities among the Jewish people?
Nachum, you're right on with the general feeling that you look at the Hasidic world historically, contemporary Hasidic world, and you think to yourself, well, that's not an example of halacha. My research is actually to have a look at how some of those ideas developed, how they were explained, and also in particular to look at the biographies of some of the Hasidic masters, who in addition to being Hasidic masters, they were also halachic authorities. So some of them even wrote responsa or works of halacha. Some of them were rabbis of cities. And to have a look at what does it mean to have those two worlds, the Hasidic world, which is an inspirational world, a world of spirituality, of religious innovation, but also the normative world of Jewish law, which doesn't have the same flexibility that perhaps spiritual experience might.
Who would be a good example of that? A Hasidic leader who was well known for Piskei Halacha, for being a decisor of Jewish law?
Well, if you go back to the early generations of Hasidism, so the Baal HaTanya, Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi, who founded the Chabad schools of Hasidism, so he wrote a very important halachic work So that's in the first, right at the beginning of the Hasidic movement. And if you go through the Hasidic movement, you can almost in every generation find some Hasidic masters who were also halachic authorities, and they're normally fascinating people because they've got two worlds, and how they, whether they mix their two worlds or whether they keep their two worlds separately, is always going to be fertile ground for interesting things.
And in his case, that's what we call the Shulchan Aruch Harav.
That's right. That's what we call Shulchan Aruch Harav. The truth is, he didn't call it a Shulchan Aruch Harav. He didn't call it anything that we're aware of because he didn't print it. It was actually printed by his sons 2 years, beginning 2 years after he passed away in 1814.
And is there
a question as to exactly how that relates to his legacy, that he wrote it but he didn't print it?
Right.
Those are some very difficult questions regarding his legacy.
And is there a good contemporary example? Is there someone in the Hasidic world today, or maybe somebody of the last 50 years or so, who separated themselves in terms of their knowledge and their reputation when it comes to halakha?
I think that we could point to the Kloisenberger Rebbe, who was originally a rabbi in Cluj, Kloisenberg, and went through the camps, and after the war was a rabbi first in the DP camps, later on in America, and then came here to Israel, to Netanya. And in addition to leading a Hasidic community and almost resurrecting the community from the ashes, he also was a recognized halachic authority who left. He was preparing, when he passed away in 1994, he'd prepared for print his tshuvot called Divrei Yatziv.
Right. And because of his circumstances regarding the war, it's very possible, and this is not to minimize his work at all, but it's very possible that he was somewhat encouraged to become a halachic authority, only because he was probably faced with questions and situations that nobody else was faced with in those days. At least
that's true. But on the other hand, you know, there were other Hasidic masters who survived the war, and they didn't necessarily become halachic decisors. Different Hasidic masters had different talents, and after the war, they used those talents to try and resurrect their communities. So if you take, for instance, the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchok Schneerson, he was a fantastic storyteller,
right,
and an inspiring storyteller. So instead of leaving halachic works, he left stories.
Right.
You have other Hasidic masters whose legacy was different. So I'm not sure if it was just the circumstances. It's also a matter of personal talents and personal leanings.
I'm a big times make the man guy, so sometimes that's to a fault. So it could be that I was just extending that a little too much. And by the way, we could explore the world of Hasidism together on another occasion with your permission, because I can only imagine how much time we could spend on that topic. It is certainly a fascinating one. Rabbi Levi Cooper is with us. Relics for the Present is the brand new book. We have a few minutes left for me to ask some questions of Rabbi Cooper. It is highly recommended, Relics for the Present, Contemporary Reflections on the Talmud, a Magid release, part of Koren Publishers with a Pardes imprint, the Institute of Jewish Studies. You're all welcome to check it out. KorenPub.com, KorenPub.com, KorenPub.com. And I thank Rabbi Cooper for joining us. So it's funny, on the jacket of the book, they printed, whoever the they is when it comes to these projects, they printed a question that I wanted to explore with you. And again, we're talking about Maseches Brachos. We know a lot of Brachos has to do with prayer and the day-to-day activities, the religious activities of a Jewish person. The first question they actually printed on the jacket, how much time should it take to pray? And they continue with, is one allowed to argue with God? Who can give a blessing, etc.? One of the things I always discuss with my boys, thank God they should continue they do pretty well in shul, is number one, how long it should take to pray. And again, we'll ask you that in a moment. And number two, how loud should one be praying, both privately and when they are a shliach tzibur? What does Maseches Brachos tell us about those questions, about the time and about the decibel level when one prays?
Well, as far as how long it should take to pray, that question, even though you know, it's dealt with in Brachot, but I think that I came to the question because I was also troubled by that very question, and I see people around me who are davening a long Shmoneh Esrei every day, and I look at them and I'm, what are they saying every day? How can they be davening so long every single day? And I find that challenging also, concentrating in prayer and being steady in prayer. So those questions, learning through Masechet Brachot, was a great opportunity for me to try and deal with some of those questions and grapple with my own challenges in prayer.
And I guess there's no right answer, huh?
That's right.
I mean, talk about subjectivity. How much time it takes to pray may be the prototypical subjective question.
Yeah, even though there are people who seem to manage to concentrate in a long prayer every day, and strength to them. For me, it's some days I'm more focused, other days I'm not, and you know, the vicissitudes of life take me to different places.
And speaking of Hasidic groups, by the way, because I tend, I'll reveal a secret to you, Rabbi Cooper, I tend when I daven as the Shliach Tzibur to be on the loud side. I don't know, maybe it's hereditary, maybe it's just the nature of my work. I feel there always has to be a microphone, even if it's a natural one. But I've been told as I've gone to different places to daven that I must be a, and I forget which Hasidic group it is, but am I right that there's a specific Hasidic group that likes to shout the davening at the top of their lungs?
Caroline.
That's it. That's the one.
That's it.
And that,
yes.
and that is in fact their truth. In other words, they believe that if you do it, you're going to do it all out with as much volume as possible.
Right. That's right. And that's, I think, for me, why the Hasidic movement is animates me so. Because if you have a look at the different Hasidic groups excel at different things. So if you're a person who loves praying at the top of your voice, then Karlin's the place for you.
Right.
And if you're a person who prefers a more reserved type of prayer, then perhaps you might want to daven with the Boyan Hasidim. If you're a person who likes a really quick davening, then maybe the Ger Hasidim are for you. And each Hasidic group, not just necessarily with prayer, but each Hasidic group has their path. And certainly in days of old, a young person could choose which Hasidic group they were drawn to, which Hasidic group they wanted to be part of. I certainly pine for that opportunity.
Do all the major Hasidic groups on this globe, the major ones, I mean, we don't have to sit here and, you know, and argue over numbers, but the ones that are considered major groups, do all of them have a presence in Israel?
Well, that's a hard question. I'm not sure. I don't think I know the answer to that question. No, I couldn't say. I would guess that they do. But I couldn't say for sure.
And do you, as somebody who has an obvious fascination with Hasidicism and continues to write about it, do you use the opportunity to visit groups or you analyze them from afar?
Well, I certainly relish the opportunity to visit Hasidic groups. I'm particularly connected to the Boyana Hasidim. That's where our family roots are from. And growing up in Australia, I have strong Chabad roots because I went to a Lubavitcher school there.
Right.
On my mother's side, there's Sochachov and Gera Hasidim. So there's a number of different Hasidic groups that are part of my history, and they're the ones that I feel most closely connected to. But whenever I have an opportunity to learn something new, to connect to another Hasidic group, so I'll certainly take that opportunity.
Well, I will reveal to you yet another secret, Rabbi Cooper, and that is that next door to us at the Mizrahi is the Bayaner Shtibel on East Broadway in New York City. And in fact, many people have said this is the only neighborhood in the world where you could have a Mizrahi minion and a Bayana minion sharing a handrail, you know, right next door to each other. So.
Well, maybe it's the only minion nowadays, but it actually... The Ruzhin dynasties, Boyanov is one of those dynasties. The Ruzhin Hasidim were actually very pro-Zionist, and some of them were even members of the Mizrahi, if you go back to the early 20th century. So Chassidus was very colorful then, and it certainly, there were different hues, and the Rush and Chassidim, actually, it's not surprising that they would share a headrail with the Mizrahi.
Well, you've just given me a very important piece of information, and I thank you for that. Finally, Rabbi Cooper, and we're speaking to Rabbi Levi Cooper. The book is an unbelievable book, and it's highly recommended. Relics for the Present, Contemporary Reflections on the Talmud, in this case, Maseches Brachos, the volume of the Talmud known as Brachos. The you talk about tempering enjoyment, and this has got to be, especially with us, because so much of what we do over all these years has to do with Jewish music. I am sure that the Hasidic groups that you've explored, so many of them have their own nigunim and joy, and their get-togethers, whether it be Shabbos Yontif or an occasion during the week, are filled with music and joy. Yet you have a chapter entitled Tempering Enjoyment, and I think this is one of the important things that we discuss so often in Jewish life, is that we are in a certain era that is lacking certain things. Maybe our joy must be tempered, yet on the other side, and especially from a Hasidic angle, a joy is so important to the existence of somebody and to their continuation. So how could you evaluate this topic for us about joy and how and when one must temper it?
Well, first of all, I'm certainly in favor of having a joyful life and of being happy. The Talmud suggests there that we have to, as you said, temper our enjoyment. And I try to, in the passage in the book, I try to have a look at that Talmudic passage and say that curtailing our enjoyment is because we need to remember that we're in an unredeemed world, that we still have hopes as a people. In our generation, we're fortunate to have the state of Israel. But we don't have peace yet in our land, and I can tell you I still do reserve duty. So yeah, great. We can be joyful, and we can enjoy life, and we should enjoy life. But we should also spare a thought for the fact that we hope that one day we'll merit full redemption, peace in our land, and peace in the world.
Amen to that. Is your weekly column on Chassidus going to be a book at some point?
Good question. We'll have to talk to the editors at Koren about that. hopefully, there'll be a second volume of Relics before that.
Oh, wow. Which would surround which Masechta?
Well, it'll be on the second half of Brachot. Ah. Relics at the moment is only on the first half.
Correct.
And I've got a manuscript that hopefully will go to print for the second volume of Relics. And then perhaps we'll move on to Hasidic material. We'll see how things go.
I should have pointed that out, that Relics for the Present is the first five chapters of Maseches Brachos.
Right.
You must meet an amazing array of students at Pardes. Am I right that you're meeting some of the great young minds of today?
Pardes is a fantastic place. I'm so privileged to teach there because it is a unique institution. It's an institution that's been around since 1972, but it has a population, a changing population. The students are intelligent, they're interesting. It's challenging to teach there because the students challenge you, and I'm very glad to have that opportunity. I think that also helps my creativity.
Rabbi Cooper, you have no idea how much I've enjoyed this hour. I hope you'll send warm wishes to our mutual friends and relatives, and I wish you the best of luck with this book. It has been an absolute delight speaking with you. Thank you for joining us here today at the Nachum Segal Network.
Thank you very much, Nachum. This is the first time I'm doing a radio interview over the phone, so I'm really grateful for this opportunity.
Well, might I say, you've performed splendidly.
Thank you.
Rabbi Levi Cooper. Originally from Australia, he teaches at the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem, serves as the rabbi of Hatzur V'Hatzar congregation in Tzur Hadassah, Israel. I thank him for joining us here today on Buy the Book, brought to you by Koren Publishers. Rabbi Cooper was, his PhD, awarded by Bar-Ilan University's Faculty of Law, explored the interaction between Hasidism and Jewish law. He's a member of the Israel Bar Association and the Tzohar Rabbis Organization and serves as a historian with Heritage Seminars. He publishes The Tish, a column on Hasidism in the Jerusalem Post, and is a contributing editor for Jewish Educational Leadership, the Lichtenstein Center for Jewish Education Journal. The book is called Relics for the Present, Contemporary Reflections on the Talmud, Rabbi Levi Cooper, a Magid release part of Koren Publishers. Magid Books offers new approaches to Jewish texts and themes from the world's leading rabbis, scholars, and philosophers. Magid is an imprint of Koren Publishers Jerusalem. We are strongly recommending korenpub.com, korenpub.com. Those of you out there who have not yet seen the site or ordered books through the site, check it out. You will be amazed at what they have to offer. Many of the works we've already examined in these weekly encounters here at By the Book on the Nachum Segal Network. And, of course, there are many others coming down the pike. I do want to mention that if you go to KorenPublishers.com, if you visit the website, you'll see a whole host of publications that have come over the, that have come out, rather, over the last many, many years. And there's a special section on the Koren Talmud Bavli. You may recall that just a couple of weeks ago we had the opportunity to speak to Rabbi Weinrib about the brand new color edition of Masechet Shkalim. They have a black and white Daf Yomi edition. They have a PDF edition. You could subscribe on the website to the entire set. And, of course, you could find them at your local bookstore as well. So check that out. Obviously, with Shkalim being a relatively short Masechta, we have more volumes introduced to you coming shortly down the road. And the Magid Parsha series has some absolutely incredible works, including Mitocha Ohel, including Covenant and Conversation, which, of course, is by Jonathan Sachs. We had an opportunity to speak with on JM and the AM just a few days ago. And Torah Lights, which is Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, another brand new incredible work. Check it all out. Go to korenpub.com and you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. Koren Publishers and By the Book is repeated Thursday afternoon Eastern time here on the Nachum Segal Network. You'll be able to check out this program on a weekly basis during that time slot. And if you're listening right now during the first run, which is Tuesdays at 10 a.m. Our live lunch is coming up from the from Kosher Fest 2013. That will go until about 1 p.m. Eastern time this afternoon. And then, of course, more great programming on the way. I thank you very much for tuning in and being part of this program. The reaction to the Koren Publishers By the Book segment, the 1 hour that we get to spend with an author each and every week, continues to be met with critical acclaim. And I thank everybody who's responsible for making it happen, for allowing us to do this, and for really providing a phenomenal forum to meet some of the incredible rabbis and scholars and authors of today. It's a unique opportunity and one that we absolutely cherish. So thanks to our friends at Koren Publishers, korenpub.com. Buy the book every single week, Tuesdays, 10 a.m. Eastern time, right here at the Nachum Segal Network. My name is Nachum Segal. Stay tuned. ¶¶